tape or whatever technology is communicating this, you can go ahead. My name is Jody Kretzman. I first came to Holden Village more than 30 years ago, and it's been a place which has nurtured my imagination for many, many years about what community is, and how do you understand it, and what's the richness of it, and how do people engage in it in ways that are immensely helpful, both individually and collectively. So Holden has been one of the real guiding lights in the thinking and work that we've been doing on community development. I'm at Northwestern University, where Andy Gordon and Margot Gordon, two colleagues who deserted us at Northwestern to come to the University of Washington for the last number of years, were with us as we began this work over the many years. So anytime I forget where I am, I will just call on Margot and Andy, and they can continue the sentence wherever I am at this point. I want to talk to you. The title of the session is the beginning of a series on stories of hope and community. And I think I want to fit it in the context of the Bible study that Dan Erlander has been doing. We work mostly with communities that would be defined by 2 Isaiah as exile communities, whether those are exile communities within the United States or on five different continents. We work with mostly communities in trouble, facing some real economic and social and political struggles. So it's wonderful to be doing this in the context of Dan's Bible study. I also want to sort of connect it a little bit with Kit's presentations. Kit has been leading us through sort of the portrait of the earth economically and politically and geopolitically as seen from 3,000 feet up, right? And we're going to go down to about 6 inches here and talk about the very local and try to relate it maybe, Kit, along the way with what you're doing with the macro kinds of pictures and international kinds of discussions. So I'm hoping that these discussions will begin to tie together in some way, and that we can have conversations throughout the week at Holden that really do integrate these various topics and themes. I come from Chicago. I was born there, raised near there, have lived almost my entire life there, and the work I want to briefly outline for you this afternoon really does have its roots in Chicago. Chicago is noted for a lot of things. We brag a lot. We're very boastful about our city. I'm a complete Chicago chauvinist. I think it's one of the great cities of the earth. We boast about our world-class architecture. It's probably the birthplace of urban architecture and continues to be wonderfully creative in that way. It's a site of world-class cultural institutions, the Art Institute, the Symphony, the Lyric Opera, and so on. We brag about our neighborhoods. We have 77 official neighborhoods, and they are lively and filled with people from all over the United States. We brag about our, you may not know this, but Chicago has the longest accessible waterfront in the world. 21 miles of publicly accessible waterfront. But perhaps our biggest pride is that we always, at any given moment, have the largest percentage of incarcerated public officials. there's an actual section of a Minnesota penitentiary just set aside for Chicago officials. They constantly manage to find their way up there. So it's a terrific city, and a lot of what goes on in Chicago is a dance between bottom up and top down. We've had a very, very powerful democratic political machine in Chicago, the Daley the Elder and now Daley the Younger, 20 years each in City Hall. So there's a powerful central force, but an awful lot of the creativity in Chicago has come from the bottom up. It's the place where Jane Addams invented Hull House, the first settlement house in the United States. It's the place where a wonderfully eccentric guy named Saul Alinsky invented sort of modern urban community organizing and put energy around the idea that neighborhoods, low-income and working-class neighborhoods, could actually have a powerful voice in speaking to central power, whether it's City Hall or the federal government or large banks. So it's a place that has always had a kind of tension between the bottom-up and the top-down. We've always been most interested in the bottom-up. What's going on in the neighborhoods? What are the dynamics here? How do they change from day-to-day, week-to-week, year-to-year? And our teachers have been people in Chicago neighborhoods, and then in neighborhoods across the United States, and now in the last 15 years or so on five other continents as well, as we've had a chance to work with folks around the world. So I want to just briefly today introduce the framework that we have really learned from colleagues in communities in Chicago and across the country. I don't want to outline you or let you think in any way that what I'm going to talk to you about briefly for the next few minutes is a set of theories that comes out of the academy. We certainly are in the university, and it's an important place to do work, and Northwestern has been very helpful in many ways to the work. But the work that we report out really is based on the wisdom of the people in the communities who are struggling to make things better. I might want to just clarify that briefly, just in terms of my own autobiography. My life probably changed most significantly many, many decades ago, when as a young person, very naive, of 19, between my sophomore and junior years in college, a number of us at my school in the North answered an invitation for some incredibly courageous young college students in the South who were part of something called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to come down to Mississippi for a period of time and help them register voters and teach in places called Freedom Schools. So a number of us went. I went for a very short time. It was just 5 weeks. And it was a 5-week period that basically turned my life around, changed the way I thought about the world. During that 5-week period, I stayed with an extended African American family of sharecroppers in Mississippi. The setting, they took me into their family and into their community in a wonderfully warm way. The setting was a family that I think at that point had 52 people, extended family, living together in 11 domiciles, 11 which you could only call shacks. At that point, 6 of the shacks had wooden floors, the other 5 still had dirt floors. There was no indoor plumbing, no running water, obviously no electricity. The highest level of formal education of this family was the 6th grade. A number of people had gotten through the 6th grade, but that's about all anybody in this community expected. But what gradually dawned on me during that 5 weeks, and they were sort of a scary 5 weeks as well as an incredibly rich one, was that I was in conversation with this family and with people who were doing the voter registration work, and I was learning more. I was learning more about themes and topics that were important in life than I had ever learned in any classroom at Princeton University, or that I would learn in returning to the classroom there and elsewhere. And it was the knowledge that was being sort of thrust at me, or really in gentle and wise ways, had to do with the most important questions in life. What does it mean to live a meaningful life? What does it mean to live in community? What is family about? What is intergenerational work about? How does faith and the arts work into life and community? Where do you get the strength and the audacity, to use a current term, to think you could change history? All of that were sort of constant in the conversation of folks in that place and in that time. Andy had similar experiences, a little in different places at that time, and I think any of us who went through that period there came away changed. And one of the things that I recognized then was that when I got back to university was that I love universities. And I was now, though, I had a little perspective, and the perspective simply was not all wisdom is resident in universities. A lot is, but an awful lot of wisdom is resident in local communities, in places where people really are trying to make a difference with each other in their lives at that historical moment. So a lot of the rest of my life since that period has been seeking any excuse I could possibly find to hang out in communities, particularly lower income communities, and to get to know people who are working publicly to make things better there. So again, anything we think we know is the product of the generous sharing of wisdom on the part of people who have turned turning their communities around. A little bit more background on the work. My main colleague in this work for the last 20-25 years has been a colleague at Northwestern named John McKnight. And about a quarter of a century ago, we decided that we would want to take, and we've both been involved in a lot, Chicago neighborhood work and and the neighborhood branch of the administration of our first African-American mayor in Chicago, Harold Washington. He unfortunately died in the first 6 months of his second term. And so a lot of us in Chicago who had been doing work in that administration, mayoral administration, were sort of at loose ends about what to do next. And McKnight and I decided that it would be really interesting to take another look at neighborhoods and what was going on, particularly then in city neighborhoods, although a lot of our work since then has been in rural neighborhoods and in small towns and in places like Native people's reservations. But at that time, we got, I won't go into the whole story, we got a generous foundation grant that allowed us for about 3.5 years to buy handfuls of airline tickets and to take off consistently from O'Hare, that's back when airlines actually worked, and to fly around the country to visit most of the 25 largest cities in the United States repeatedly, and then some small towns and other places as well. And in those places, to seek out the most devastated neighborhoods or communities and to visit the devastated neighborhoods over and over and over again. So we spend a lot of time in places like the South Bronx and New York City and Watts in Los Angeles and Liberty City in Miami, the east side of Detroit. Public housing all over the place was a place where we were constantly finding ourselves. Then Native people's reservations, Appalachian towns where the coal mines had closed, some struggling agricultural towns. And sometimes when I recite that itinerary, people look at me with a good deal of sympathy in their eyes. And they say, boy, what a terrible way to spend 3.5 years. That must have been really depressing. And of course, the report to you is it was exactly the opposite. It was completely exhilarating and filled with hope. And the reason partly was that we had begun to have a network of connections of people in tough situations who were making a difference, first. And secondly, McKnight and I had decided that when we went into these places, we weren't going to ask the usual questions about how bad things are here. Tell us about the dropout rate. Tell us about the crime rate. Tell us about the teen pregnancy rate. What's gone wrong here? That's the usual set of inquiries, particularly that people from universities tend to make when they go into struggling or lower income communities. But instead, our major question was, what's working here? Is there anything at all that's maybe under the radar in this tough situation that's actually succeeding? And so we started collecting success stories, or what we then started calling them hope stories. And at the end of the 3.5 years, not all of these were collected in person, and we had some graduate students and some assistants working with us, and some of them we dug up on phone interviews. But we had over 3,000 of these hope stories. You don't call those stories in the academy, they're cases. So you collect cases if you're in the university. If you're in a community, you collect stories, pretty much. And then we picked the 250 favorite ones after conversing with people across the country where we've been doing this work, and we put them in a book called Building Communities from the Inside Out, which we tried to arrange in a way that the central lessons that we learned from our teachers and communities became clear. And it's those central lessons that I want to share with you very briefly this afternoon and then get into whatever discussion you want to get into. Much to our surprise, by the way, this book took off and has become, we are told, the best-selling book in the history of community development literature. Now, that's not a big pond, right? But there are some significant pieces of work. It means that there are about 125,000 of these things around in the community development world. Just an aside, some of my most gratifying moments come when I see this book, which is now about 15 years old. We've done 20 other books since then, but this is still the major one. When I see it in unlikely places. So I was working in Ethiopia last summer, and after doing some workshops and seminars and talks in Addis Ababa, I usually try to arrange my travel so that in return for doing some stuff in the major cities, I get to go out into the villages, and they'll take me around to see what people are doing. And in one of the first villages we visited in Ethiopia, it was about a 3 or 4 hour trip in a 4-wheel drive. By the way, it's so wonderful, trips to Africa, and you must see this, to see places that actually need four-wheel drive vehicles, right? that aren't just driving around the suburbs with it, right? But where the roads disappear and there's nothing but a rut, you know, and you're going over rocks and mountains and then you wouldn't make it without a four-wheel drive. Anyway, we're sort of bouncing around for 3.5 hours. We come to this small village that these people wanted to take me to. And we go into the hut in the middle of the village, which is sort of the village center. And it's a round crawl that you find in, throughout Africa. And the village chief is in there with a couple of his other leaders. And he's sitting at a card table, which is the sort of village headquarters. And he greets us. And on the corner of the card table is Building Communities from the Inside Out. And what was wonderful about it is it was all tattered and torn and worn, right? Like they'd been actually reading it and using it, tearing out pages. So sometimes that happens, and it's a wonderful moment when it does. Well, to the central lesson. We learned so much. There were so many lessons, and we continue. If you do this work in community, the learning never stops. You're constantly picking up new sets of strategies, new sets of perspectives, new contexts in which people are doing the work, new connections that they're making between economy and polity and social relationship, new ways, kid, in which they're sort of thinking about the very local in relationship to the global, through the national, mediated, and so on. But we're I think, still convinced that the lesson that became clear to us at that time still holds as a valid center for the work, and that's what I want to outline for you real briefly now. For me, it probably came as the clearest light bulb. It was a gradual kind of development of thinking like this, and McKnight had come at it in one way and I'd come at it in another way. But for me, one of the light bulb moments came when I was visiting a woman in the South Bronx who had become an incredibly important person in my life, a real teacher, named Mrs. Edna Johnson. And she died now about 9 years ago. And I try to tell her story occasionally to try to keep her name alive, at least in some people's minds. But Mrs. Johnson was in the South Bronx. She was an African-American woman. When she died 9 years ago, she was 84. And the last 50 of her 84 years, she lived in the South Bronx. Now, some of you are old enough to remember when the South Bronx was, by general acclaim, the most devastated neighborhood in the United States. You remember when that was sort of the case? Paul Newman made a movie called Fort Apache, the Bronx, right, where everybody was shooting each other all the time, and the police had this fort that was the police district station in the South Bronx. And it was a tough place. The South Bronx was just a quick sketch. South Bronx was a place where over 100,000 jobs left in a 15-year period. So the economic rug gets pulled out from people. The South Bronx was a place where all of the major institutions were clearly broken. The schools didn't work. They were making students dumber. Criminal justice system didn't work. We're making people more criminal, not more just. The South Bronx was the birthplace of a practice that then got imported into our town in Chicago with devastating consequences, called arson for profit. Do you know about arson for profit? Right, where landlords, that absentee landlords who owned big buildings in low-income neighborhoods would stuff them filled with poor people, low-income families, milk the rent for all they were worth, not put a dime back into the building. The building would deteriorate, everything would come apart, the electricity would go off, the water wouldn't work, rats and roaches. So it was unlivable, but the people left. And as the last act to make a little bit of insurance money, the landlord would hire a torch to burn down the building. That was arson for profit. And that devastated the South Bronx. One estimate was that about 30,000 units of affordable housing were lost in the South Bronx over a decade to arson for profit. And we then got that in some of our neighborhoods, including my own in Uptown in Chicago, for a period of time in the 70s as well. So the South Bronx is a tough place. But my friend Mrs. Johnson was somebody who, underneath the radar, was constantly working to make hope stories happen. Right? She was the person who would get together with neighbors to take the park back from the drug dealers and make it safe for families once again. Or she was the person who would find some concerned parents and teachers and turn the elementary school around and make it a place that once more actually taught kids something. Or she was the person who would work with local religious congregations and involve them in the life of the community. Or she was the one who would work with people to get a commercial strip that had been burned out put back together again. She was never in the headlines of the New York Times, but she was, if you asked around who did this or who was involved in this story, pretty much if you scratch beneath the surface, there was Mrs. Johnson. So she was our guide over a number of years to hope stories in the South Bronx. One morning, one hot July morning, I was there and she had, we'd been communicating, doing phone calls back and forth, and she said, you know, I've got three or four things, Jody, I'd really like to show you if you could get out here again. So I went and I spent a couple of days, and one morning, she and I spent 3.5 incredible hours with a group of 14 young African-American guys between the ages of 15 and 22. And it was in a sort of apartment on the second floor with no furniture. And we sat around for 3.5 hours. These guys told us their story. And it was an amazing story. And the story briefly was that 1.5 years prior to our visit, they had been in the middle of, they were from two rival gangs, and they had been in the middle of a protracted gun battle that was related to a drug war in the South Bronx. And in a period of 10 days, 15 of their friends and colleagues were killed. 15 kids died within a 10-day period. And that was extraordinary even for the South Bronx. So a few of these young men at that time said, we can't go down this path any longer. If we do this, we're dead or we're in jail. We've got to do something else. And they eventually sort of expanded their ranks to 14 people who sort of did an agreement with each other and said, you know, let's work together, we'll help each other, we'll try to figure out how to get out of this. But of course they had no idea about how to do that, right? And but you know, two of the guys, luckily for them, knew Mrs. Johnson. They said, Mrs. Johnson always has an idea, let's go see her. And so they did, and Mrs. Johnson had an idea, as she always would. And her idea this time was, she had just the previous month learned of a wonderful new, just brand new experiment going on in the neighborhood south of the South Bronx called Harlem. And in East Harlem was the first testing of an experimental program which is now national in scope and in most major cities called Youth Build. Do you know, anybody here know about Youth Build? It's a terrific program. I mean, basically what it does is it takes gang kids or kids in trouble and teaches them carpentry and painting and drywalling and all the stuff you need to rehab an apartment building, and then arranges opportunities for them to do that. And so the first group of young men in East Harlem were doing that. They were rehabbing their third or fourth apartment building when Mrs. Johnson found them. So what happened was Mrs. Johnson took the kids from the South Bronx down to see the people in Harlem, and the kids from the South Bronx got entirely taken by this idea and said, Mrs. Johnson, we want to be the second branch of Youth Build. And so that's what we talked about. We talked with the 14 young men whose lives had been turned around by this opportunity. And it was just an extraordinary, you know, now kids, a number of the young men had finished their GEDs or were about to. Half a dozen of them were apprenticing with local construction unions and were beginning to make some good money. A few of them were beginning to think about college. Four or five of them talked about being back in touch with children that they had fathered and then abandoned, right? And back in relationship with folks. So it was a very, and it was just an extraordinary, energetic kind of a morning. And Mrs. Johnson and I enjoyed it a lot, went back to her place, sat on the front porch, debriefed it, and Mrs. Johnson was something of a visionary. She could immediately say, this is something we ought to be taking national. Let's think about what the strategy is for taking this thing national. And now it is national. It's a very, it's the kind of thing that actually works in cities. There's a pause in the conversation. We're sitting on her front porch sipping tea in the South Bronx, and I decide somehow, I don't know why, to ask her a question I'd never asked. And I said, you know, that was a wonderful story. It was terrific to meet those young men and to hear that, and you know, you've done so many other kinds of things. But I said, you know what? It's still the South Bronx. This is still an incredibly devastated place. And I said, I want to ask you a question that I never asked you before. And the question is a simple one. What went wrong here? How do you explain the devastation that you still see in the South Bronx? And my friend, Mrs. Johnson, was an incredibly thoughtful person. And she just paused, and there was a silence for maybe 30 seconds, 40 seconds. And I think what she was doing during the silence was scrolling through her mind all of the potentially correct answers to that question, right? Well, it's the 100,000 jobs that left. It's the arson for profit. It's the broken institutions. It's the racism. It's this place has gotten more black and more brown, more of the resources have abandoned us. But it ended up, after 30 or 40 seconds, that she didn't say any of those things. Instead, she said, she looked up and she said, you know, I haven't thought about it quite this way, she said, but the more I think about it, Jody, the worst thing that ever happened to us in our community is that we got put into a prison. And I was baffled by that. And I said, I have no idea what it is you're talking about. We're sitting on your front porch. We're looking at a streetscape. There are some buildings that are still standing and look to be in good shape. There's a couple of burned out ones. There's some empty lots. But what there is not is a high barbed wire fence. What there's not is a set of guards with guns, right? We're not looking at a prison scene here. What do you mean? And she said, well, you're right. It's not a literal prison that we've been put into. But then she uttered the phrase that we've been sort of kicking around ever since. She said, the prison I'm talking about is a prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are. Other people's ideas about who we are in my community. And I said, well, that sounds important, but I don't quite get it. Would you say a little bit more? And she said, well, let me just tell you what happens to me every week. She said, I'm involved in so many things in this community that I have to go downtown to City Hall and see some politicians and get some support for it. Or I have to go out in the suburbs and raise a little bit of money from some wealthy religious congregations or funders. And she said, what almost always happens to me is I go in and introduce myself. I say, hi, I'm Mrs. Johnson. I want to talk to you. I called you here, and I wanted to talk to you about my neighborhood, maybe you getting involved with it or supporting some of the things we're doing. And she said, they're always friendly. They're always, they seem glad to see me. And we sit down, and they said, now remind me, Mrs. Johnson, what neighborhood is that? And she says, I try it when they ask about what neighborhood it is, I try to say it with a lilt in my voice. It's the South Bronx. I'm from the South Bronx. But she says, the lilt never works. The minute I say the word South Bronx, I can see what happens to their heads. Right? Their heads just fill up with all kinds of images and ideas about where I live and who I am and who my neighbors are. And she says, what's so devastating about the ideas and images is they're all of a piece. They're all consistent. And they're all about our problems and our needs and our challenges and our deficiencies. Give me a little help here. What kinds of images would you imagine she's talking about?
Negative.
Yeah, but specifically.
Boarded up housing.
Yeah. Boarded up housing.
Gangs.
Yep.
Scariness.
So.
Yep, isn't that where Vampire of the Vanities? Isn't that where he gets stuck in the?
Say it again.
Isn't it the South Bronx in Vampire of the Vanities that he gets?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. That's seven. So Mrs. Johnson was one of the people that taught us to sort of begin playing with something like this. This is a neighborhood needs map. Can you see it? Is it clear enough? This is not a map of a piece of geography, whether it's the South Bronx or any place else. It's a map of the mind. Oh, I know about that place. That's the place characterized by crime and child abuse and welfare and slum housing and truancy and illiteracy. And this is the map that Mrs. Johnson was telling me constitutes for her and her neighbors a prison. You see how that might work? Right. Let me just make a couple quick comments about it, with your help. A word about, let's think for a minute about where this map comes from, who creates it, and then we'll think for a minute about what its consequences might be. Remember how Mrs. Johnson phrased it to me? She said, this set of ideas is a set of ideas that are other people's ideas about us. So she was telling me, this set of ideas doesn't come from us. It's not what we think on my block, me and my neighbors. It's somebody else is thinking this about us. So if you were to think about institutions or systems that think this about lower income neighborhoods, or say about Native people's reservations or other places, who does this? Who draws the needs map? The floor is open for nominations for Cartographer of the Year. Who draws this map?
Oh,
Outsiders.
Outsiders of a variety of ways. Okay, can we get more specific?
We do.
Oh, okay, we do, certainly.
Governments.
Governments. Who said governments? How's that work, Karen?
Well, both it would be city, county, state, even governments, the
school districts.
School districts, right.
All of those that do surveys and go to the cities.
Yeah, and the surveys are always about this, right? And governments are one of the big sources of funds for communities, right?
As are banks.
The what?
Banks will do the same.
Banks will do the same things, draw lines around communities, not put investment in, not put mortgage money in, absolutely. Anybody here ever work in the nonprofit world and write a grant proposal, for money? What's the first page of a grant proposal, whether it's to the government or to the Ford Foundation?
Needs,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a needs statement, right? It's the, you'll get money if you're good at drawing this map, right? So we have set up a game that says, the better you are at telling us about how bad things are, the more likely you are to get resources, right? Do you see how that, anybody else got an idea about where this map comes from?
Media news.
Absolutely. If we were sitting in the black community in the west side of Chicago in a church basement and we were talking about where does this come from, the first people they would say is the media. And they don't mean community newspapers, right? They mean the downtown papers and the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news. We've got a journalism school where Margot taught for a long time at Northwestern, and it still has some grizzled old ex-journalists teaching there who say to their fresh young journalism students when they go out to cover, quote, inner city neighborhoods, what's the rule? If it bleeds, it leads. If it bleeds, it leads. What's news out of these kind of neighborhoods? It's not the opening of a new, church. It's not the creation of jobs. It's the blood. It's the drive-by shootings. It's the drug wars. So we've got government funders, I'd say United Ways, the mass media, and let me just add one more. Most social science is about this, I think. Most social science is about examining causality and figuring out what went wrong here and what are the dimensions to what went wrong and how do you understand the relationships between all of the things that went wrong, right? It's a sort of a, and so when a university says, you know what's most important about low-income neighborhoods? It's this. It's the deficiencies that they exhibit. Now, let me be clear here. This is a true map. I live in a neighborhood called Uptown, and we've got all of these things in Chicago, in my neighborhood. The problem with the map is not that it is a false map, it's a true map. Problem is, it's taken as if it's the whole truth, and it's not, right? That's the difficulty. We're constantly reminded that the power of this needs map has devastating consequences. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but here are just a few of them. If that's the only map to reality, a number of things happen to people in the community. The worst maybe is this first one. If I've been told often enough that my reality is my deficiency and my neediness, I sometimes, thank goodness not all the time, internalize that. And I say, that must be true. I don't know enough to raise my kids. I don't have the skills to enter the job market. I can't join with my neighbors to make this place safe. I'm a deficient person. If we think our community is nothing but a collection of problems and challenges and needs, why would we ever turn to each other in our local community to solve problems? Because there are no resources here. Why would we turn to our local church? Why would we turn to our neighbors, to our local businesses? And those local relationships, therefore, get damaged because they're not used. It's like a muscle. A relationship is like a muscle. If you don't flex it and use it occasionally, it atrophies. That needs map determines how money comes into communities in narrowly defined, what's sometimes called categorical funding. Here's your teen pregnancy money, and here's your crime money, and here's your ex-con money, and never the overlap shall meet. The money often goes to professional helpers, not residents. Leadership changes here. Let me just say a word about this briefly. When I was trained as a community organizer, one of the first lessons that we learned was when you go into a new community, the first thing you do is you look for people called natural leaders, right? who are the natural leaders? And we're not talking about office holders here or people who are visible to people outside the community, but who is the mom on the block that all the young moms turn to when they've got questions about their kids? Who's the guy on the block who can fix anything and who everybody knows can fix anything they turn to? These are the natural leaders. Today, however, because the needs map has determined so much of our dynamics in the community, we have leaders whose major skill is not getting something done with people on the block, but whose major skill is raising money. And they raise money by being incredibly articulate about how bad things are here. So in a sense, their skill, their leadership skill, is a skill of denigrating their neighbors, of saying bad things about the community, right? That's a different kind of leader. And I think we need more of the former and not that kind. All of that leads to failure. If you want more money next year for teen pregnancy, you have to go back to your funder and say, we did everything we could, but we have more young girls pregnant this year than we did last year. We need more money. So the worse we do, the more money we get, right? This happens in international funding too, kid. I think you see it all over the place. And all of that leads to a poor self-image and a kind of hopelessness. Now, one other symbol I want to just give you real quickly here. We never go anyplace without this hackneyed cliche, right? You can all see what it is. It's the half full, half empty glass. And I think with the continual lesson in community work is it, as in almost all work, I think, that involves our contact with each other in human life, is that this hackneyed symbol of the half empty, half full glass is true, profoundly true, on two levels. Number one, it's true of every individual that I've ever met, and here at Holden or any place else, that everybody I meet, including certainly myself, has a good deal of fullness, gifts, skills, capacities, talents, energies, and everybody has some emptiness, some problems and deficiencies. When you're working in an organization that works, whether it's Holden Village or whether it's a university, if it works, you're working in a place that in a sense is a part of a vast global conspiracy. Places that work conspire to do almost all of their work together based on the full part of the glass. What people like to do, what they can do well. So that I think the central management challenge for people who run organizations is, how do you take screwed up people and find what they can do? Find their gifts and their skills and their capacities and their passions. That's true on the individual level. Similarly with neighborhoods, with communities. No matter how poor or how wealthy, every community is partly full and partly empty. It's just that we have been taught to look at some neighborhoods through glasses that see only the needs and the problems and the deficiencies and the emptiness. And other neighborhoods, the leafy, wealthy ones, sometimes behind gates, we see only the fullness, right? Where we know perfectly well when we get inside those communities, there are problems and there are difficulties. Every community is a combination of both. Community development, we think, concentrates on the full part of the glass. And so we have been overjoyed to see in our trip in the 3.5 years and then in the subsequent work that we've done since then, people, in a sense, throwing out the needs map and beginning to get quite serious about drawing an alternative picture of themselves, an assets map, where local institutions, associations, and individuals' gifts and capacities are recognized. One of the things that really surprised us, I think, when we started taking a look and lifting up the themes and the major sort of threads that when we talked to people about, now, how did you take that park back from the drug dealers? How did you turn that school around? How did you create those jobs? People would tell us a story, and we began seeing this pattern, that in almost every case, the story was partly about how did you find resources that were right in front of your face, right there in the community, in terms of the people there and some other kinds of resources, and put them together so that the story could begin to happen. And we started seeing a pattern. And the pattern was that people seemed to think that their communities had a set of ingredients, like a cake, that made up their community. And we're pretty clear now that almost every community I've ever visited, I'd say every community, is a unique combination of these six kinds of ingredients or resources or assets. And that community development that's hopeful starts with this and builds on it. Now, this is not rocket science, but you know, sometimes this word community gets a little bit mushy. It's hard to get your head around what it is exactly. But this is a way. It's not the only way, but it's a way of saying, well, how do you make specific and concrete the ingredients that make up a community? And these six categories are the ones that seem to have emerged out of the work that we've done with communities. So the first one is, let's take every resident here in this housing project or on this Native Peoples Reservation and think about them in terms of the full part of their glass. What are their skills? What do they know about? What are they passionate about? What do they care about? What's the full part? Not just how much they can't read and when they dropped out of school and how often they've been in jail. What do they care? What's their skills? And so I'll show you, if we get a moment, some examples. We've collected now a bunch of examples, thousands of them, of skills inventories or capacity inventories that communities use to get at the full part of individuals. Secondly, every community is filled with voluntary groups, the face-to-face, relationship-driven ways in which human beings come together to do our work together or to do things we enjoy together. Religious institutions are critical in both exemplifying and multiplying voluntary associations of this kind. A lot of people have looked at American history and said, you know, one of the geniuses of the history of the United States is it was built on voluntary associations, right? It was built, this is the insight of that wonderfully strange French hippie Count Alexis de Tocqueville when he came here in the 1830s and looked around and saw that the genius of America was not just its sort of economic activity, but the fact that small groups of unelected local people were getting together to do all kinds of things, to build churches, to build businesses, to build hospitals, to build schools, to make things happen in local communities. It's still true today that an awful lot of what gets done in a community, particularly lower income communities, gets done through these voluntary groups where people don't get paid. So it's the block clubs, and it's the churches, and it's the choirs, and it's the softball teams, and it's the women's groups, and it's the reading groups, and it's the environmental groups, and the Kiwanis, and it's the service club, et cetera, right? It's that part of our community. We think it's incredibly critical. Sometimes those groups get squashed because we pay so much attention to the third category, which is the places where human beings get together to do things, and they get paid to do it, right? So there are governmental institutions like schools and libraries and parks and other kind of governmental agencies, and there are businesses, and there are nonprofit agencies of all kinds where people get paid to do the work. Those are critically important assets as well, but we are constantly working with people to distinguish between the second and third categories. Fourth, fifth, and sixth, really quickly, whether you're working in a rural community or an urban one, the physical assets are critical. What's the land, the transportation, the infrastructure of a community, the economic assets. Even in the poorest community, people work economically together. They produce things, they consume things, there's barter going on. We did a study some years ago of a desperately low-income high-rise building, a housing project with a couple hundred families in it that everybody thought was basically a set of desperately poor people, which it was, mostly single family, single women households. And it turned out that this one public housing building spent over $8 million a year on the top categories of food and children's clothing. Forget what the third one was. But of course, the problem was there were no stores in the community where you could buy any of that, so they had to buy it all a couple miles away, and therefore all the money that was in the community left the community. And finally, sixth, and this ties in a little bit with what Dan Erlander has been doing in terms of the the exile, the stories and the heritage and the local identity and the values. We think it's incredibly important if we're working in communities, if anybody's working in the communities, to begin gathering the stories that people tell you when you say, well, what's this place like? They're not going to give you the sociological statistics. They're going to tell you some stories about what the place is like. And we're particularly interested in the stories where people really had experienced the place as a community, where it had done something successful. Let me just, I want to have a few minutes to answer questions, but let me just wrap real quickly with a couple of quick examples just to make sure we've got the point here. Two different ways to view an individual. The first way I want to show you real briefly is from a welfare department. It's an interview format prepared by the state welfare department for welfare workers, and it's meant to guide the welfare worker to what is important to know about an interview, about a human being in the first time you encounter her or him. This happens to be from the welfare to work world, right, where somebody is, every state now has this, where if you're on welfare, you've got a limited time to get off it and begin looking for work. So here's the first encounter between the authoritative figure, a state welfare worker, and a young woman starting on the road from welfare to work. Tell me about your inadequate housing, your limited job skills, the job-seeking skills you don't have, your poor work history, how often you've been fired from jobs or quit them, you don't have any recent work history. Tell me about your high rate of absenteeism, the high school diploma or GED you don't have, the training. Well, maybe here's finally a neutral question, how old are you?
Yeah.
But then you get back into the part of the glass you really want to know about. Are you a pregnant or parenting teen? Are you a single parent? You don't have any child care? You do have skills, but unfortunately they're not in demand. No transportation, no driver's license, you've got six dependents, it goes on and on. You don't communicate very well, do you? You're uncertain about your employment goals, they're unrealistic. You don't have the right clothes, tell me about your family problem. Now tell me about your bad eyes and your bad ears and your bad teeth. Other medical problems, your family and friends won't be very supportive. Tell me about your history of mental illness, your felony record, how often you've lost your benefits. And then they have the gall to say, now please share any additional information necessary for developing a plan for achieving your training and placement. Any reactions to that?
I'd be devastated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
See all your shortcomings right there.
Absolutely. Yeah, if I'm being interviewed. By the way, I think if I'm a 24-year-old single mother of three from the public housing development on welfare, this is maybe the 15th time in my life since kindergarten that somebody in authority has sat me down and done this to me, interviewed me about all the grades I've failed and all the things I don't know how to do in school and how far I'm behind and how often I've been in trouble. Not only low income, we've got stacks of these, unfortunately. People know we're interested in this and they send us these examples. And it's not only about low income people, we've got a stack of them that happen to young people. The minute a young person encounters the juvenile justice system, somebody will sit them down and start asking questions like, how often have you contemplated suicide recently? Tell me about how much you drink and how many drugs you take. And tell me about your gang affiliation. And tell me about how often you were beaten when you were a kid, right? On and on, never anything about the full part of the glass. We do it, obviously, another set of people, we do it to all the time, people with disabilities. People with disabilities are constantly being asked about what they can't do, not what they can do, right? And that community, happily for all of us, has rebelled about that and said we're not interested much in that anymore. We've got a stack of these from Immigration and Naturalization Service. It turns out that an awful lot of the first interviews with new immigrants are about tell us all the trouble you've been in your villages, wherever you're coming from, right? We know now, and my hair is grayed a little bit, I know that it happens to older adults, that more and more of the questions you get asked are, you know, what's broken now? What can't you do now that you used to be able to do? I think the most unfair question I get is, what can't you remember that you used to be able to remember? Right? I don't know, I can't remember. Very unfair kind of question. So this is it's a set of examples of a pattern, we think, where authoritative institutions in the culture are encountering people and labeling them by their emptiness, neediness, and deficiency. And in a sense, making sure that that identity is the identity that determines how their life experience is going to be. So it's a way, in a sense, of marginalizing folks and making sure that the fullness that they represent, their skills and capacities and energies, are not recognized, and that they're not recognized, therefore, as contributors to the community.
And that's a prison.
That is a prison. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Let me just end with the glad tidings. The glad tidings are that the stack of examples of stuff that's the opposite of that is now much higher than the combined stacks of the stuff that's like that. Let me just show you one. We collected lots of these. But communities have sort of said, we understand the game of big institutions telling us about how bad things are. We need to construct our own ways of having conversations that demarginalize people, that recognize their fullness. And I won't go through the whole story. It's a wonderful story. But this is a sample of a capacity inventory that was invented by a Baptist church in Cincinnati, Ohio, and used in a soup kitchen. There's this New Prospect Baptist, the largest African-American church in Cincinnati, still runs a huge soup kitchen operation. 7 nights a week, they feed over 300 people in the soup kitchen. What happened was that a bunch of people in the church, some years ago, got frustrated by seeing the same people back every night for the meal. And they started saying, you know, what's the problem here? Can't we be doing more to help them not need the soup kitchen, turn their lives around? And they asked themselves, well, why aren't we turning their lives around? Their answer was interesting. They said, you can't turn the life around of somebody you don't know. We don't have relationships with these people. And then they paused a minute and they said, now wait a minute. We do know quite a lot about many of their emptinesses. We know many of them are homeless and jobless and fighting drug and alcohol problems and are estranged from the family. What we don't know is anything about the fullness. So this is a one-page survey questionnaire, also used in a sort of the same way the welfare interview was, one-to-one conversation, 15 or 20 minutes. But here we're after gifts and skills and dreams. And so they sat down on one-on-one, the leadership of the soup kitchen, and interviewed people coming in over a cup of coffee about what are your gifts. They called it a gift exchange. Basically, we believe everybody has God-given talents and gifts that can be used to benefit our community. Gifts are abilities we're born with. What positive qualities do people say you have? I just love the phrasing of these because it's a very respectful set of questions. And they thought about it for months before they finally came up with this form. So you don't have to brag. You know, you can say, somebody once said I was a good listener. I'm just reporting. Who are the people in your life you give to? How do you do that? When was the last time you shared with somebody else? What was that? You got a lot of answers there about a brown paper bag and a wine bottle the night before. That was fine. What do you give that makes you feel good? And then skills. What do you do best? What do you enjoy doing? You could start a business. What would that be? I love the third question here. This is our vocational question every day, right? What do you like to do that people would pay you to do? Right? Ever made anything? Ever fixed anything? And then dreams. What are your dreams? If you could snap your fingers and be doing anything at all, what would that be? And these were not people who had been asked very frequently about their dreams. I visited the soup kitchen about 6 months after these interviews started, and I had visited before a number of times because we worked very closely with the pastor, Reverend Damon Lynch at New Prospect, over the years. But it was a different soup kitchen this time. Big, old, one-story industrial building, whitewashed cinder block walls. Used to be pretty dingy, but it wasn't any longer, because the first thing they did, they didn't want to just gather information, they wanted to do something with it. So the first thing they did was they constructed what they called walls of fame. And two of the walls now were covered with splashing, you know, bright colors, each contained in a geometric shape. So the walls were filled with triangles and circles and rectangles, and inside each geometric shape was a person. Often a caricature of the person's face or a blown-up picture, photograph of the person, and a list of gifts and skills and dreams. And so the walls became a celebration of what they had found. But they weren't just after a snapshot. They were after living walls that helped in constructing community and developing community. So, for example, in the first 240 interviews, that's how many they had done when I got there, they had found almost 40 people with carpentry skills, who reported being able to do some carpentry stuff in the first 240. They put a big symbol next to each one of those of a brown saw. And then they had a thick brown squiggly line that went all the way around the wall and stopped every time it got to another saw. So the people with carpentry skills were led to see who else had carpentry skills and meet each other and talk with each other. And what I learned was that the previous month, about 15 of these guys, they did happen to be all guys, had formed an official carpentry co-op, a 501c3, and they were now busy rehabbing apartment buildings and doing construction projects in the community. Another finding, the first 240 interviews, almost 80 people reported musical skills, singing or playing an instrument of some kind. So during the dinner hour, the first time I was there, the first part of the dinner hour featured a 15 voice choir made up of people who had sung in a variety of choirs before. And it really was a pretty good choir. And then the second half of the dinner hour was a 5-piece jazz combo made up of people who had discovered each other through this process. It was not the greatest jazz combo I've ever heard before, but they were spirited. So it was a soup kitchen that had been transformed in a variety of ways. One last thing about it. When they asked people, what do you do best? What do you like to do most? Much to the surprise of the volunteers who were doing the interviews, one skill got mentioned far more frequently than any other skill. And they had to take it seriously. Any ideas about what that skill might be?
Tell stories.
Could have been tell stories, wasn't. Could have been that one. It was cooking. Cooking in a soup kitchen. And so the church folks began thinking, now what is that about, right? Why is everybody saying, I love to cook, right? I cook a mean pot of chili. And then the more they thought about it, the more they understood what they were hearing. They were not hearing people just reporting a particular skill called cooking. They were hearing people say, you know what? I don't want to be on this side of the table any longer. With you on the other side of the table, cooking for me and serving me. Because as long as I'm over here and you're over there, I'm nobody. And you are a completely valued human being. I want to come over on the cooking side. And I want to be a completely valued human being too. And so the church folks decided, man, that's a pretty profound challenge. We need to do something about that. And they were very gutsy and wise, and they decided they would do something, and they ended up doing two things. The first thing they did was convene the 60-plus volunteers who were regular volunteers at the soup kitchen, and they said, thank you for all the work you've done. We really appreciate it. We want you to stay with us in the soup kitchen. But there's a new rule at the soup kitchen. If you want to volunteer here, come hungry. Nobody comes just to cook or to serve. This is an eating community, and we're all going to eat together. And they got a little pushback initially, you know what, you want us to eat with those people? Yes, we do. But that had all gone by the board by the time I got there. And now the volunteers were bringing in their families, and it was really much more the feel of a community kitchen or a community meal than it was a soup kitchen. Then the church people said, now what are we going to do with the people coming in for a meal? I think it's not going to work if we just change the rules. What should we do with them? And they came up with a wonderful community development idea. They went back and they picked the 20 most enthusiastic would-be cooks, the people who just jumped out of their chairs. I love to cook. They went back to those folks one-on-one and said, you know, I noticed how excited you were about cooking. We really need you in the kitchen. We're a little short. Would you mind, if we give you a little orientation, being part of the cooking team in the kitchen? And what they reported to me, the church leaders, was that 19 out of the first 20 people they asked just jumped at it. And within a few nights began showing up in the kitchen. And many of them began showing up multiple nights per week. And then what happened, far more quickly than most people in the church expected, was that other people coming in for a meal, waiting to go through the buffet line and be served, began looking back into the kitchen and seeing their buddies back there. What's Charlie doing back there? Well, he's part of the cooking team. And far more quickly than they expected, folks began saying, now, that's interesting. Do you need anybody else back there? I'd be willing to help a little bit. Or if you've got too many people cooking, could I help serve? Or I notice this place is a mess at the end of a meal. I'd be happy to help wash dishes. or clean up, or how about a little music at supper time? And that explained why what I was seeing in the soup kitchen had sort of puzzled me for a bit. And the reason was, I was looking around at a place that had over 300 people in it, lots of activity going on, and having been in a lot of soup kitchens in my life, this was the first one I'd ever been in, where I was looking around and it dawned on me slowly, I don't know who's who here. I don't know who are the volunteers from the church, and I can't distinguish them from the people who have come in off the street for a meal. Somehow that became for me then a powerful microcosm of what I think a healthy community is. A healthy community has nobody who is defined as empty, needy, and problematic. Everybody is recognized as gifted, and the pledge is your gifts will be given. And a community is a place where everybody's gifts get given. I think that's also a profound understanding of what a local version of democracy is. That's what a citizen is at the local level. A citizen is somebody who joins with neighbors in public to make something better in the community. So the soup kitchen was also, in my mind, a kind of radical experiment in the creation of local democracy. I still think that no matter what happens in November, the most important outcome of this season of public life will be the energizing of local citizen activity, no matter who wins at the national level. So that's what the asset-based community development work has been for us. It turns out that when people in Kenya or Ethiopia or South Africa or Brazil or Ecuador or Vietnam start thinking this way, it's not because they've heard this language or these categories, it's because it makes sense at the local level to start with what you've got and then see what else you need from the outside. And in a sense, you don't know what you need until you know what you've got. So it's a very simple idea. I'm almost embarrassed to talk about it because it is so much common sense, but that's what it is. I think we're close to the end of our time at this point, but if there's a question or two, I'd be delighted to respond. Yeah.
I come out of the revenue department, and we continually have community empowerment zones, tax increment financing, all that kind of stuff. Have you ever seen any of those programs work?
Well, we did a lot of work in the early Clinton administration on their design of the empowerment zone nationally. We worked a lot with Gore at that point. The early design of the empowerment zone nationally was had a lot of this in it. And I think the shift that we're interested in with governments and funders from the outside is, in a sense, one simple way of thinking about it, is a shift from charity to investment, right? The old way of doing business is you tell us how bad things are and we'll pour programs in and solutions in from the outside, from the top down. And I think what we're thinking about here is how, if we've got some outside resources we want to put in there, how do we invest them wisely in local assets? So the first actor is the local community. What have you put together locally that's worth investing in? And so the requirement of the empowerment zone, if you remember, was that each city or rural area that was applying for it was mandated to pull together as many people, associations, institutions as possible and do a planning process. Pull your assets around the table, figure out how to harness them to some kind of a vision, and then the government will come in and invest in your own problem solving. Now, a lot went wrong with that when push came to shove, but the conception of it, I think, was right. And I think there's some promise still, but the funders and governments need to do things in a lot different way. The World Bank internationally, I think, needs to retool its thinking about local economic development and not do the top-down stuff, but begin to sort of invest in local solutions and local energies. And that's a huge challenge. We're talking about that in the presidential campaign. We'll see how much of it can get done. Well, thank you. You've been most patient.
Thank you.